Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Ben. Tim. How are you?
Very well, thanks. So before we start this episode on leadership, we thought we might just press rewind a little bit to episode 2, where we had Dr. Dan Pronk. And he's just published a book called The Average 70 Kilo Dickhead, talking about his journey, love that title, from triathlete, professional triathlete, to special forces doctor, to dealing with loss and post-traumatic stress. And now Dan is a serial entrepreneur and author. I love the interview. What were your top takeaways?
Look, I reckon the first one, Dan, and I've witnessed this throughout his life, being his brother, but this idea of little incremental improvements.
Breaking the goals down into manageable chunks and then persistently chipping away at those sub-goals until they add up to the overall objectives.
And it links to one of our favourite poems, that a little further line, the idea that you just chip away at it, you do these or develop these systems where you can continually develop. You're not trying to tackle the whole mountain at once. You're eating the elephant one bite at a time, if you like, and through
preferably
that process,
from the head.
Preferably from the head. Yeah. Are we mixing our metaphors? That's where the fish rots from. But through that process, you develop this unconscious competence. You one day wake up and you're actually quite good at stuff. So that was my first one, that idea of going a little further. And my second one was the title itself, as we had a chuckle during the interview, but Average 70 Kilo Dickhead, I reckon pretty well describes Dan to a T, but it pretty well describes most successful people. There are very few of these sort of prodigal genii out there. Generally, it is just average 70 kilo dickheads who commit themselves to making themselves better and end up very successful as a result.
Exactly.
What about you?
Were you ever a 70 kilo dickhead?
we laughed at that with Dan. I'm 85 kilos of shredded muscle, but definitely a dickhead. What about you, Tim? What did you take away from it?
So my top two was how Dan explained dealing with loss and failure, and it was in response to the question that I posed to him about loss on the battlefield, loss of life on the battlefield, nothing more profound in that respect. And he explained the way he overcomes it by doing two things. The first thing is looking forward. And the second thing is having the discipline to keep looking forward. Mm. And that's all about the post-traumatic growth that he narrates.
There's a lot of discipline in that really initial incident that you just fall back on. That once again comes back to your training. And then you have to start to work out how you're going to process all of this psychologically. And I think this comes down, particularly from a leadership perspective, to a huge amount of emotional intelligence. And that initial post after action review, if you like, is critical to get right.
And my second one was having the strength to quit. There's an oft used phrase called failing fast, but Dan talks about transition and transition from failure, and specifically how he arrived at the realization that he was never really going to be a competitive triathlete and making the decision to quit that.
How did you know it was time to stop your triathlon, apart from the fact that you sucked?
Yeah, well, I mean, that was exactly how I knew. It just took me 5 years to realize it.
And of course, deal with all of the emotional repercussions of quitting. So I really like those two.
No, I think it's good, and it links to that idea of self-awareness, which is so critical. And as we talk about leadership today, I reckon that'll come back up. And of course, we forgot to mention the life-saving tip from the battlefield: keep a tourniquet in your car.
Keep a tourniquet in your car. That's right. So from Dr. Dan Pronk, if you can do one thing that's applicable from the battlefield into your homes, go and buy yourself a tourniquet. And if you haven't listened to that interview, please circle back. Dr. Dan Pronk, the average 70 kilo dickhead. Now on with the show. So Ben, today we're going to talk leadership. It's a very overused word. It's very overdefined. And it's very underperformed. and one in which success is very hard to define. In fact, I like the way that Simon Sinek, the British-American author, the speaker and consultant, has explained leadership, and he talks about it a bit like going to the gym. You can't just do it once and see immediate results.
You're a testimony to that, Tim.
I've done 2 hours in the gym this morning. Right. I certainly didn't see any results. And you also can't do it 8 hours in any one given day and then not do it again for a year. Mm. It's a constant process of doing, learning, adjusting, and redoing. Now, we're the first to admit that we don't know it all when it comes to leadership. And I'm sure there are many people out there that have often thought that we are, you and or I, are terrible leaders. But we were fortunate enough to go to a leadership school, the Royal Military College, and that, perhaps some would contest this, has been talked about as one of the premier leadership schools. And I guess when we graduated from that, we were forced to lead by virtue of appointment. That was the aim of the college, was to graduate people to lead platoons or equivalent. And probably more importantly, we were expected and even obliged to mentor and coach junior leaders. And we've both led on operations and we've both led businesses. And in fact, you also teach leadership inside a top 50 business school. So we kind of want to start there. And the question that I'm going to come back to is the similarity between mayonnaise, rainforests, and leadership, which I've heard you talk about. But let's start, before we go to mayonnaise and rainforests and leadership, talking about your opinion on the contrast of leadership in the military and leadership as taught in business school, because both, of course, teach leadership.
Yeah. It was quite interesting doing my own MBA, having, as you mentioned, benefited from the military background and not only the Royal Military College, but the continuum of leadership training that you received throughout, both as an officer and a soldier within the military. And then hitting the MBA, where I was surrounded by these incredibly smart, very technically competent, and quite frankly, amazing men and women at that cusp of transitioning from being a doer in an organisation to being a leader of that same organisation. And I was staggered by how unprepared many of them were in a formal sense. So while the military, you can pick holes in the continuum of training, at least there is that sort of structure. There's that systemized process that we spoke about before that helps you along the way. It sows those seeds and provides the theory, which you then have an opportunity in your day job to put into practice. Now, I'm a massive believer that in a leadership sense, theory is necessary but not sufficient. I think you definitely need an understanding of some leadership theory of how people work, how the world works, and how this idea of leadership can be put into practice. But you can't become a leader by just reading a textbook. You then need the opportunity to put it into practice. And I think the military does that well. It provides that theory, and then, as you mentioned, through your day job, it allows you to put it into practice. I think some businesses almost expect you're going to gain that by osmosis, that you will do your technical job for 10, 15 years, and then one day you'll wake up in a position that you can lead 400 people. And sometimes that works really well. Other times I feel people aren't set up for success to make that transition.
And I remember back at military school, they talk about three styles of leadership. Quite a simplistic model, the first one being authoritarian, you know, follow me. The second one being participative, you know, what do you guys all think? And the third one being free reign, just do whatever you want.
Yeah, yeah.
And whilst that's a very simple model, those three things are still applicable. And I really like the structure of what you teach at business school, which is complex, adaptive leadership. So maybe that's a good segue into complexity versus
complicatedness.
Complicatedness. And of course, mayonnaise and rainforest.
And fighter jets. So a big part of that very simplified model is that there are different leadership styles which may be appropriate in different situations. So understanding your environment is a really key part of being an effective leader. And the mayonnaise and rainforests is a wonderful analogy developed by a guy called David Snowden. So Dave Snowden is a Welsh knowledge management expert. And in fact, back in the day and to this day, but certainly in my experience, we had a lot to do with him within the army. He was very generous of his time in helping armies across the world, but including ours, think about complex problems. And it's funny, I sort of joke about the idea that within the national security sense, we had two Snowdens in our life, and we certainly preferred Dave over the other one from a security perspective. But Dave Snowden uses this analogy of fighter jets and rainforests to describe the difference between a complicated and a complex environment. And he says a fighter jet is to a rainforest as a complicated environment is to a complex one. What he means by that is that both fighter jets and rainforests are made up of a whole bunch of interrelated parts, different agents, if you like. The difference being that a fighter jet works in a linear fashion. There is a repeatable cause and effect relationship between all of the parts within that system. So you can diagnose it using very deterministic procedures, and you can do things in a repeatable fashion. If you pull a lever one way, the plane goes the opposite way, and that happens each time. A rainforest, on the other hand, still made up of a whole bunch of interrelated agents that have these connections, but there is no predictable link between cause and effect, and there's no repeatability in the system. So if you sort of have one intervention in the system, there's no guarantee that it'll work in exactly the same way the next time. And this is why we have things like, or disasters like the introduction of the cane toads into Australia in 1935, where, you know, we'd seen that, you know, we could introduce the cacti blaster moth to deal with our prickly pear. And so ostensibly a very similar intervention to get rid of the cane beetle, but of course disastrously different results. And so this is that idea of complexity. And this is crucial for us as leaders because this is the world we live in. We live in a world where there is no predictability. There is no or very limited amounts of repeatability because we're dealing with a complex environment. We're dealing with people, with these autonomous agents who have all got their own idea of what success looks like and have all got their own agendas, their own sort of ways of pursuing their goals. And so that, I think, is a really fundamental place to start our view on leadership. The environment that we live in is not predictable and it's not repeatable. And so we need to be constantly in a position where we can adapt. We can sense what's happening. We need to guard against things like confirmation bias and falling in love with our plans and stay really open to those weak signals in the environment that may be indicating that our plan's falling apart and we need to change and adapt.
So I understand that battlefields are complex. And you recently talked about complex adaptive leadership to a major oil company. Is it relevant there as well?
Yeah, without a doubt. And this is where it's important as the next step in this understanding to recognise that these things aren't mutually exclusive. It's not like we have a complex environment that has no complicated bits in it. And this oil and gas, and in fact any human endeavour, will have lots of, Snowden talks about these different environments, simple, complicated, complex, chaotic. But there'll be components of simple and complicated processes within all our environments. So you've got very highly complicated technical processes in mining or oil and gas or any industry. These are often what you're first employed to do, and so you get very good at, you know, operating drilling rigs or working an underground mine. These are hugely complicated, but they are repeatable. There is a process behind it. You can diagnose using linear cause and effects. They may be existing within a wider complex environment with people and shareholders and stakeholders and the media and all sorts of different unpredictable elements. And so it's important to understand when we're dealing with a complicated environment and we can use a cause and effect technique to address it, we're dealing with a complex environment and we need to be more adaptive. We need to remain open and receive that feedback from the environment.
And to my earlier question on why rainforest is like mayonnaise, that's to do with the complexity. You can't, once you've made mayonnaise, deconstruct it
in
the same
exactly
way that
right.
You can't deconstruct a rainforest.
Yeah, there's no going back. And in fact, the original, we talk a lot about wicked problems, but the very original sort of article, a guy called Weber and Horst Rittel, I think, but they've got 10 characteristics of wicked problems, and they're fantastically instructive, but they talk about this idea that a wicked problem has no stopping rule, so you can't just call time out and rewind. Once you've engaged with this wicked problem, it keeps going, and it's almost like that, you know, you may not be interested in war, but war's interested in you. Well, these wicked problems, even once you lose interest in them, they remain interested in you. They keep bubbling away.
That's right. So rainforest, mayonnaise, fighter jets. I also saw you talk about Prussian generals and boxers.
Well, this links to that idea of non-linearity, and I like to juxtapose these two quotes. The first one is that Helmut von Moltke the Elder, who was, of course, a famous early 19th century Prussian military theorist, who spoke about no plan survives first contact with the enemy, quite a famous saying, which is absolutely true and absolutely speaks to this idea of complexity, that as soon as you make that mayonnaise, as soon as you engage with a complex system, your plan's not going to work out how you thought it was. And of course, that's been updated more contemporaneously by the famous modern martial theorist Mike Tyson, who says everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. And I think I like that one even better, because often real life can feel like a punch in the face, particularly if you've spent all this time planning. You've developed this wonderful plan, you trick yourself into thinking that you're prepared, and you also start embedding this idea of confirmation bias. You fall in love with this plan, you eliminate any possibility that something else could happen, and then all of a sudden the wheels fall off, and it's like Mike Tyson punching you in the face.
Yeah, and you know, you and I know that a plan is nothing but a common basis for change.
It's a great way to look at it.
Yeah. And what's more important, the plan or planning?
Yeah, 100%. And is this our last dead army guy quote for the
yes,
episode? So that's Dwight Eisenhower, needs no introduction. But yeah, the plan is nothing. Planning is everything, which again, I use a lot in the lecturing, because I think that is just such a beautifully succinct way of looking at this. And if you can keep those in the back of your head, that you've got a plan until you're punched in the face, and that plan is nothing, but the process of planning is everything, then I reckon that's a really good footing as a leader to embark on any endeavour. You know, that you need to have this plan, you need to have the process of planning, you need to have thought about this stuff, but it is folly to expect that it'll roll out exactly as you've predicted.
So you've learnt the theory in military school, you've learnt the theory in business school, you've also put it into practice in uniform, on the battlefield, on operations, and also in business. So there's the theory and the practical part. Let's perhaps transition across to the toolkit and how we practically apply some of those things to get the best results, to create, or maybe to define success in that word, leadership inside that complex adaptive environment. And the one thing I really like, which is a 1980s theory, which was popularized by Hewlett-Packard, is management by walking around, often called management by wandering around, MBWA. And it was pioneered actually by Bill Hewlett and Dave Packard in the 80s, and it's also been written about in a couple of books published in the mid-80s, including A Passion for Excellence by Tom Peters. And it's the practice that you just need to get up from your desk and go and walk the floors. And ideally, walk the floors to the forgotten teams and the forgotten people, those people perhaps who are down in the sub-basement, and just sit with them. And I know that when I was in the SAS regiment, and also in business out of the Middle East, I used to do that quite a lot. In fact, once I came and sat in your troop office when we were both in uniforms, and you see some peculiar behaviours when you're sitting silently in the back corner as the boss. But also down into the quartermaster's store, and certainly in business, going and speaking with those people that generally don't get that management interaction, and listening to their issues and concerns. Thoughts on that? Management by walking around?
100%. I would say it is critical. It shouldn't, in my view, be seen as just walking around is going to make you a good leader. You know, I think that is a vehicle for achieving a lot of the the sort of good things we were speaking about. Now, leadership is fundamentally a contact sport. It is, you know, there are some very successful virtual leaders, you know, and the environment we're going into, that's going to be demanded more and more, leading virtual teams. But there's a very human element to leadership because people aren't following you, in my opinion, for sort of technical sort of accreditation or because you're sort of good at solving spreadsheets. They're following you because you inspire them at some sort of human level. And it's very difficult to do that without some kind of personal interaction. So that's one thing. The second thing is it's part of this two-way communication. And there's a really critical component of planning, which is that back briefing. So getting everyone on that same mental model, we'd call it, but essentially the same song sheet, so that when we roll a plan out, we know why we're doing what we're doing. And we know, you know, if things go awry, kind of what the boss would want us to do, what the intent is. And a big part of that is actually speaking to people. And it's not just the verbal communication. As we know, whatever it is, only 20% of our actual communication is conveyed through words. It's reading people's micro expressions. It's seeing their body language. And you very quickly understand whether they are actually bought into the plan or what you're discussing, or whether there's some reservations, whether there's some concerns, and it's much easier in person to unpick those. And I think the third point is exactly what you've said, that idea of getting to, I think you call them the forgotten people. I don't know if they'd like to be called that, but...
no names, no pack drill.
Though. Yeah, yeah. I'm glad you included me as a forgotten person when you were my boss. But... in many ways, it's looking at those informal hierarchies. So we tend to just think, again, you know, that very complicated sort of view of the world where we talk to a manager who talks to a sub-manager who talks to a sort of next person in the chain of command. But of course, as humans, we don't always work like that. We've got different people within the organisation who may have a lot more connections. Malcolm Gladwell talks about this really in a very interesting section of Tipping Point, but talking about the disproportionate sway that certain people like connectors or mavens have. And they're within everyone's organisation. We know who they are, and they're not necessarily in those positions of power. You'll often find people like executive assistants who everyone needs to speak to the EA, so they become very good connectors in many cases, and often repositories of a lot of information, and people who can get out information, they can ground truth and get out information to a whole bunch of areas within the organisation. And as you mentioned before, in the military sense, the QE, the quartermaster, the person who's always got the blankets and bullets, they're not necessarily on that formal hierarchy wiring diagram as a sort of leadership position, but they're very influential in most military organisations.
That's right. They're the two people you don't annoy in the military. The first cook is the quartermaster because he gives you your gear, and the second is the cook. It's true. And you know, when we talk to leaders and we work with many of them, we kind of tell them to do less. So it's a fantastic way, that management, by walking around and eliciting opinion and getting feedback in that participative style, it's a great way to inform your own decisions and harness all of those colleagues and co-workers from the sub-basement through to the 34th floor.
Yeah. And we've gotten, I think, modern society has gotten into this very bad habit of thinking that we need to be physically doing something, that thinking, actually reflecting on decisions and plans and you know, business structures is not a productive use of your time. And you're seeing some very effective leaders now starting to just pencil in thinking time or me time or sort of time out sort of periods where they actually reflect and are able to absorb all the information that they've got from walking around and actually come up with ideas.
Yeah, so it's practical and also, you know, it's somewhat metaphoric and theoretical, you know, eliciting that. In fact, a quick anecdote, in 2001, you know, I was in Sierra Leone in West Africa as an advisor to the government of Sierra Leone, and we were down on the Sierra Leone-Liberian border. And I used to employ management by walking around. And this one particular day, I was sitting quite close to the quartermaster's store, and a shipment of equipment had come in. And all of these young Sierra Leone Army soldiers were walking past and each had two helmets. And I thought, this is peculiar, as they walk through in their dozens with two helmets per person. So I went and spoke to the quartermaster. I said, why are you issuing two helmets per person? He said, well, sir, this shipment is 200 helmets, sir. The company, 100 people, sir. Two helmets per person. I said, quartermaster, how many heads do they have? And he looked at me without answering, and he looked at me like I'd solved the Rubik's Cube. Suffice to say that 100 helmets came back. Let's talk about leadership as a currency. Mm. I mean, how can you build the currency? To Simon Sinek's point, you can't just go to the gym for 8 hours, and you can't go to the gym once and expect to notice the difference. So how do we build a bank of currency, and maybe also what is the currency of leadership?
Yeah. I mentioned before that leadership's a contact sport. It's a fundamentally human skill or endeavour. And I reckon if you had to invest in one skill, it would be communication skills. It would be the ability to speak to people, small groups, individuals, large groups, and actually convey a message. So it's fine to come up with these fantastic plans and do all your reflection and all this sort of thing. But if you're unable to communicate the information, thing one, but thing two, inspire people to actually buy into this, then it's very difficult to achieve effectiveness as a leader. And this, to me, is something that you can get better at. I think we often think that you've either got it or you don't. These very early ideas of a great man sort of leadership theory, and I use that man very deliberately because it shows how dated this sort of theory is.
Yes.
But the idea that you're born with it, and if you're not a sort of 6 foot tall, you know, commanding presence sort of extrovert, then you're not going to be an effective leader. That's obviously complete hogwash, and we're seeing more and more, you know, leaderships, all sorts of shapes and sizes. But what they do have in common is an ability to get a message across. Mm. Again, this doesn't need to be that extroverted sort of Tony Robbins-style personality. Guys like Mark Zuckerberg, you know, obviously different opinions on him, but no one can say that he's not achieved a great deal of success in his leadership of Facebook, certainly not an extrovert, but a good example of a person who has worked on that communication skills, worked on his ability, challenged himself to get better at communication, at public speaking. And so I think that's an area where we can develop skills. We can work on, you know, even things like sort of Toastmasters clubs, taking opportunities to speak in public, and at a higher level, things like learning some of these charismatic leadership tactics, as they're called, you know, using stories, using metaphors, using similes, using rhythm, using your voice, all these sort of concepts that help us appear more charismatic and become more influential in our leadership. Mm. It's very much an element of theatre in leadership, which I think is quite important and something we can practice and improve on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Which do you prefer, the optimistic leader or the pessimistic leader? And often, surrounded by pessimism, good leaders are forced to be optimistic.
Mm.
The other side of the equation on the communications point, because I think you're right, you know, that has to be number one in the toolkit. You talked about the ability to speak well and be convincing, is the listening part.
Yeah.
We've worked for many people who were great orators,
yep,
but perhaps were not considered great leaders. And the management by walking around and the ability to listen to people from sub-basement to floor 34 is really important. And when you ask the questions, because only in asking the questions do you get the answers, and those questions have to be framed right. So when you're asking the question, you can actually use a little tactical questioning technique. There's not too many interrogators that ask closed questions.
Yeah.
They actually ask questions that start with one of the interrogatives, so who, what, when, where, why, how. And if you try and if you ask someone a question that begins with one of those words, it's nearly impossible to say yes or no.
Mm-hmm.
You have to actually give a more complete answer. So there's a little technique that stimulates the listening.
Yeah, and you need to be open to it as a leader. And I think this links into probably that second really key characteristic is that idea of humility. again, I think we're subconsciously brainwashed into thinking that to be an effective leader, you need to have all the answers and be sort of infallible. This, again, harking back to that great man idea of sitting on your white horse and having all the solutions. But no one does. And so this idea of being open to different opinions and actually really being receptive, not seeing them as a challenge to your leadership or your plan or your idea, but seeing them as a way of improving your plan or idea. You can always take credit for it later on. You can pretend you came up with it, which I made a career of in the military, taking credit for other people's brilliance. But you want to be open to it. And things like formalised ritual dissent, so formal red teaming, formal yes. devil's advocacy, where you actually change...
The learned insubordination.
100%. Mm. And, you know, you can really turn these... You know the people in your organisation. You know the critics who are going to be white-anting your plan. Well, why not harness that? Why not get that person involved? A, it gives him or her ownership. So, you know, kind of subconsciously tricks them into getting on board. But B, it gives them a chance to be heard, but they will often have some really good points. They will have that nagging little flaw in your plan that they want to pick at. Well, why don't you use that as an opportunity to improve your plan, to try and mitigate that or reduce that flaw or work out, is that actually a plan killer? Is that actually a fatal flaw that we actually need to go back to the drawing board on?
That's all we got time for in this split episode of Leadership as a Contact Sport. First up in part B, Ben and I talk leading counterterrorism assaults, accomplishing more through swarm leadership and servant leadership, and we reflect on how I got intergenerational leadership so very wrong. We'll also take some questions from listeners. We both hope you've enjoyed part A. See you for part B on the Unforgiving 60.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback. Any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers.